From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson is off this Memorial Day. It's Here and Now. And we start in Portland, Oregon, where tomorrow the man arrested and charged with killing two men on a commuter train will be arraigned. It's not yet known if he will be charged with a federal hate crime. According to witnesses, Jeremy Christian was making anti-Muslim threats to two teenage girls, one wearing a hijab, when three Good Samaritans on the train tried to stop him. Christian pulled out a knife, stabbing and killing two of the men, seriously injuring a third. 16-year-old Destiny Mangum was one of the two girls. She spoke to KPTV.
They lost their lives because of me and my friend and the way we looked. And I just want to say thank you to them and their family, and that I appreciate them, because without them, we probably would be dead right now.
Noel Crombie of the Oregonian joins us now. And Noel, you know, let's start with these two men who died. Everyone's calling them heroes. The youngest, Talis and Myrdin Namkai Meche, forgive me if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, was 23. Rick John Best was 53. What are we learning about them?
Well, we know that Mr. Namkai Meche was a 23-year-old Reed College graduate. He was from Ashland. His mother said that he lived a joyous and full life. He was a man whose enthusiasm was infectious. He graduated with a degree in economics in 2016 and stayed on in Portland, where he found work at a local consulting firm. One of his colleagues described him as bright, dedicated, kind-hearted, a good friend. Mm-hmm. And they praised his selfless bravery.
Well, there was a woman who, according to reports, was with him as he died on the train, Rachel Macy, and she says his last words were, "Tell them, I want everybody to know, I want everybody on this train to know I love them." Really quite something there. And Rick John Best, you know, also just doesn't seem like a likely hero, you know, not wearing a Superman outfit, but again, jumped in.
Yes, we know Mr. Best was an Army veteran. He was a one-time candidate for a local county commission. He was a City of Portland employee. He was a technician with the city's Bureau of Development Services. He was on his way home to his home in a suburban city called Happy Valley. He had three teenage sons and a 12-year-old daughter. He, like the other victim, was from Oregon, grew up in Salem, attended a high school in Portland, met his wife at a community college here. He had served in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Leaving children. And the third Good Samaritan rescuer who survived was young himself, 21-year-old Micah David Cole Fletcher. We know he survived. And there's a GoFundMe campaign, actually for the families, I think, of all of the victims to help pay for Micah David Cole Fletcher's health costs.
That's right, and to support the families of the other two victims. So far, when I last checked, those efforts had raised $700,000.
Well, and Jeremy Christian, the alleged attacker, we know the FBI and the U.S. Attorney for Oregon are working with the local police to determine if this is going to qualify as a federal hate crime. Some would say that it would seem obvious, but putting that aside, he was on police radar, we understand.
He was on the radar. He was a known extremist. My colleagues and I have spent the past several days mining his social media accounts, talking with his friends and associates. He was not shy about his extremist views. He posted in April on his Facebook page, "I am trouble." He shared anti-Muslim memes, espoused Nazi beliefs. He called Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh a true patriot. He is now in a Multnomah County jail, facing aggravated murder and attempted murder charges.
Yeah. Well, Mike Bivens, who's a journalist there in Oregon, tells the New York Times he encountered Christian at a free speech march being held by conservative groups last month. Christian was yelling racial slurs there, threatening Muslims, Jews, fake Christians. And also eyewitnesses on the train say that he said to these two young women, "Get off the bus, get out of the country. You don't pay taxes here." How is the community there responding today?
This crime has stunned Portlanders and Oregonians and has brought a lot of support and praise for the three men who intervened. A vigil held in Portland on Friday night drew thousands of people, including Mr. Namkai Meche's mother, who spoke briefly with my colleague Beth Nakamura, who said that the mom said her son did the right thing. And by the way, there was a fourth Good Samaritan we learned about on Sunday. Micah David Cole Fletcher is eager to talk with the man who is so far unidentified, who rushed to his side as he was bleeding and pressed a cloth to his neck, managed to find Mr. Fletcher's phone and call his mother to relay what had happened. Mr. Fletcher is eager to meet that man and thank him.
And one last footnote. We began the report hearing from Destiny Mangum, one of the two girls who was being harassed by the attacker. One of the girls wore hijab. Destiny did not, and she says she's not even Muslim. Noel Crombie of The Oregonian, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on, Robin.
We'll follow that story. Meanwhile, an Obama-era rule about retirement savings is set to take partial effect early next month, shocking many. The so-called fiduciary rule requires that retirement advisors act in their clients' interests, not in their own. When first called for by President Obama in 2015, people were surprised to hear that wasn't already the standard. Republicans in Wall Street, though, say the rule would raise costs. And when the Trump administration delayed it earlier this spring, many thought it would be nixed. But Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta announced last week it will be allowed to go forward as the Labor Department gets public comments. So what happened? Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is called Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
You know, when this was first announced, I remember we had a conversation and I said, wait, they don't already have to have our best interest at heart as being brokers? I mean, this was stunning to people that they don't.
Yeah, and it's so weird because you think, you know, someone who's going to actually give me financial advice, you would think that should be a rule that would be mandated, but it wasn't. And remember that what most of the financial professionals out there are held to is something called suitability. That means whatever they sell you or advise you to do, it has to be appropriate given who you are and your risk parameters, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in your best interest. And I just want to say that distinction can get very gray.
Yeah. Well, first, let's just dig a little deeper. So can a broker, for instance, do something that may not be in your best interest but might get him or her a big percentage and might be more in their interest?
Yeah, let me give you the clearest example of this. If you came into my office and I'm a broker, I'm not held to the fiduciary standard, and you come in and you say, I'd like to save for my kids' college education, and I would like to use a 529 plan to do that. Can you help me with that, Ms. Jill, the registered rep or broker or agent or whatever I call myself? And I say, sure, I'd be happy to help you out with that. I can take care of everything for you. And, you know, just want to let you know I'm going to get paid a little commission for doing that. And you say, okay, fine. Now, that's suitable advice for you. You've said you want to save for education. What I don't have to tell you is that there is a cheaper alternative for you, that you may be missing a way to get a state benefit by using your own state's plan, or that you really don't need me because it's a kind of easy transaction.
Okay.
So that's the distinction that gets very fuzzy.
So this is what led to the fiduciary rule, which is supposed to take effect. But what's happened under the Trump administration?
So what had happened was this rule that was set to go into effect that would apply to just retirement accounts only, this Obama-era rule, was set to go into effect on April 10th. The administration that came in, the Trump administration, delayed it until June 9th. And at that point, most people thought it was going to be dead. However, the new head of the Labor Department, Alexander Acosta, said, actually, we're going to let the fiduciary rule for retirement accounts go into effect on June 9th, while we still take note and we take some comments, but it's going to be the rule that applies to retirement accounts.
Why do you think that happened?
I have no idea, because frankly, every single person that I spoke to who was very well informed on the matter was shocked by this turn.
Well, it could be that it just doesn't sound good to take away a rule that would ask that brokers make deals in your best interest. In the meantime, Jill Schlesinger, just through the few seconds we have, what should someone do? So the rule's going into effect. But how do you, if you're looking for a financial advisor, how do you ask them, you know, are you going to abide by the fiduciary rule? Are you going to take my best interest at heart? How do you find out?
Well, I think what's important is that, remember, this rule only applies to retirement savings. So right. I think any consumer who's trying to get financial advice should just ask a question. Hey, Mr. Ms. Advisor, are you held to the fiduciary standard? Now, if the answer is no, then your advisor is going to, again, provide you with suitable advice, may not be in your best interest. So I think that that's kind of your lead question. And after that, you can start to ask different additional questions. How will I pay for your services? What experience do you have? Do you have any credentials like a CFP certification? Are you a member of the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors? What services do you offer? These are all questions that you are entitled to ask. And I think that just asking whether or not that person is held to the fiduciary standard and whether his or her firm is held to that standard is your first icebreaker.
Okay. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always, and a thoughtful Memorial Day to you.
And to you as well. Thanks very much.
Today is Memorial Day. It's also the 100th birthday of President John F. Kennedy. His legacy is still very visible on Cape Cod, which juts off Massachusetts like a flexed arm. Deborah Becker from Here and Now contributor WBUR takes us down a cape, as they say in Boston. There's a JFK Museum, the JFK Memorial, the JFK Legacy Walk, and of course the Summer White House, the so-called Kennedy Family Compound in Hyannisport.
It is a symbol of the Kennedys because so much happened there.
92-year-old Bob Ludington was, and even though he retired just last year, still sometimes is an interior designer and consultant for the Kennedy family. Ludington was close to First Lady Jackie Kennedy, whom he says sought refuge in the family compound in Hyannisport, especially after JFK was killed.
But it was during that period after the president's death that she immersed herself in many, many hours in the restoration of that house.
The three Kennedy homes are in an unassuming residential neighborhood, mostly obscured from street view by tall wooden fences and shrubs. Ethel Kennedy, JFK's sister-in-law, still lives there. JFK's summer home is now owned by Ted Kennedy Jr., son of the late Senator Edward Kennedy and currently a state senator in Connecticut. Ludington has dozens of Kennedy artifacts, including several notes JFK's mother, Rose, wrote to her children.
She bombarded the children with notes, two or three lines, dashed off every day.
After she saw a photo of her son in the New York Times, Rose Kennedy wrote the young president and offered some advice on his appearance,
suggesting he not stand with his hands in his pocket, but rather keep them down at his sides. P.S. Otherwise than that, you're okay.
Ludington, like many Cape Codders, has fond memories of being so close to the country's most powerful family. He remembers Jackie Kennedy arranging for him to fly to Washington with the president when Ludington did some work for the family in D.C.
I had the great privilege of flying with him in the helicopter from Hyannisport and then Air Force One onto the White House. I had many wonderful experiences with the family. I was very fortunate.
No matter where you go on Cape Cod, it seems you'll meet people with memories of JFK, his campaigns for office, his love of the sea, or seeing him or other Kennedys at some of the family's favorite haunts like Baxter's Boathouse or Four Seas Ice Cream. Many people say they were energized by the young, ambitious politician who made Cape Cod his unofficial campaign headquarters. It was Hyannisport where JFK waited for the presidential election results in his razor-thin victory over Richard Nixon. And it was at the Hyannis Armory on November 9, 1960, where JFK gave his first speech as president-elect.
The election may have been a close one, but I think that there is general agreement by all of our citizens that a supreme national effort will be needed in the years ahead to move this country safely through the 1960s.
The nation's first Irish Catholic president was cheered in much of Greater Boston, but not necessarily throughout Massachusetts. John Allen, executive director of the John F. Kennedy Museum, says JFK's nephew, Robert Kennedy Jr., has explained that it was discrimination in the 1920s that led his grandfather, Joe, to buy a summer home in a place where he felt accepted.
They came here because they were welcome. And it was Bobby Kennedy who pointed out that they originally were moving south of Boston, and this one club the dad wanted to be part of would not let him in because he was Catholic and Irish.
Cape Cod was a Yankee stronghold forever. There were no Catholics on Cape Cod, you know. At least they didn't admit to it.
Father Michael Fitzpatrick is pastor at St. Francis Xavier Church in Hyannis, also known as the Kennedy Church. Rose Kennedy attended Mass daily, and the Kennedy family paid for the church altar, which is designed to memorialize the president's late brother, Joseph Kennedy Jr., a Navy pilot who died in World War II. At 47 years old, Father Fitzpatrick was not around when the president worshipped at his church, but there are signs throughout the church. Even the pew where JFK sat is marked with a plaque. Father Fitzpatrick says the family's faith was important and helped make them seem accessible.
The fact that they would come and worship like everybody else, it's a grounding point. People are coming here to see and to learn of the legacy and where he sat and all that kind of stuff, which is beautiful. And at the same time, it can, if we're not careful how we set that in context, it can put the emphasis on the wrong syllable, you know, because they didn't come here to be worshipped. They came here to worship.
Cape Cod is where the Kennedys came to be together. Most family members still visit every summer. One often mentioned JFK quote is, "I always go to Hyannisport to be revived, to know again the power of the sea." Again, John Allen with the Kennedy Museum.
This is really where they enjoy themselves. President Kennedy particularly would come here and he could decompress. He could, you know, really think things through. He could kind of relax.
Some say the largest part of JFK's legacy in Massachusetts is the 40,000 acres of coastal land known as the Cape Cod National Seashore. It was JFK who signed the law converting some 40 miles of coast from Chatham to Provincetown into a national park so it's protected from development. William Burke, a park historian, says Kennedy knew the geography of this isolated part of the Cape, the kettle ponds, the marshes, and the beaches.
I think every day I see his fingerprints all over this park. John F. Kennedy was in the right place at the right time for the formation of this place.
Kennedy officially created the National Seashore in 1961. He had been working on preserving the area while he was a U.S. senator, and it was not smooth sailing. Local officials and private property owners were concerned about the feds taking control. But Burke says Kennedy's skills allowed him to navigate the politics of six small New England communities and reach an agreement with the federal government, local governments, and the property owners involved.
This is such a permanent, lasting reminder of Kennedy's legacy and fortunately his forward thinking to not only preserve the land, but he had an intimate understanding of what Cape Codders were like, how they thought, and kind of the magical, mystical characteristics of the Outer Beach.
At the entrance to the Cape Cod National Seashore Visitor Center, there's a quote by JFK that says, "We are tied to the ocean. And when we go back to the sea, whether to sail or to watch, we are going back to whence we came." For Here and Now, I'm Deborah Becker.
Well, today, President Trump placed a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery.
Thank you for joining us as we honor the brave warriors who gave their lives for ours, spending their last moments on this earth in defense of this country and of its people. Words cannot measure the depth of their devotion, the purity of their love, or the totality of their courage.
Well, many are visiting national cemeteries today. Staying on Cape Cod, there's a tradition at the National Cemetery there that we feel a special connection to. Here's Here and Now's Alex Ashlock.
Hundreds of volunteers flock to this cemetery, as they do every year now, for Operation Flags for Vets. Before they fanned out across the rolling grounds, they got instructions about where to place the flags.
Okay. Do we put it in back of the stone?
No. So what happens is, actually you have it right here. So in front of the stone, it's squared, right? And you put it right in front, right
to the
center.
So the name is here.
Right. And you'll be right center right there.
Okay, great.
And you'll see it.
Today we will place upwards of 70,000 flags. one on each grave of every soldier here.
A Massachusetts father, Paul Monty, started Operation Flags for Vets because he wanted to make sure that American flags would fly over all of the graves for the holiday.
Let all who gather here on these hallowed grounds remember that freedom is not free, that our freedom has been paid for by our soldiers in uniform who have sacrificed so much, their blood, their sweat, their tears, and in many cases, their own lives.
Those lives include Paul's son, Jared, a soldier who was killed in Afghanistan in 2006. He's buried in Section 11.
Over there we had Sullivan over there.
Danielle Fetterman was nearby. She was with her young son and daughter.
I told them the real meaning of Memorial Day is to honor our men and women that have fought for us, that freedom isn't free, and we're to read each stone before we put the flag in and thank each one individually.
Paul Monty still drives the old pickup truck his son Jared drove before he was killed. A songwriter in Nashville heard an interview with Paul about his son and his truck on this program in 2011. She wrote this song, which was recorded by Lee Bryce.
I drive your truck.
On Saturday, Paul Monty proudly parked his son Jared's truck once again at the Massachusetts National Cemetery, and then he drove it home. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Yes, sometimes I drive your truck. I leave that radio playing, same old country station where you live.
Hope you're having a meaningful Memorial Day. It's Here and Now.
And you'd probably punch my arm right now if you saw this tear rolling down.
And in the high desert of Southern California, there's a town called Adelanto. For years, its survival has depended on the money it gets from detaining immigrants. That could change if a state lawmaker has his way. Lisa Pickoff-White from Here and Now contributor KQED reports.
From the outside, the Adelanto detention facility looks like a business park rising from the sand, rocks, and scrub brush. It's California's biggest immigration detention center and holds as many as 1,900 people. The little city of Adelanto gets about $4 million a month from Immigration and Customs Enforcement and contracts Geo Group, a private prison company, to run the facility. Adelanto's known as a prison town. It has more detention facilities than supermarkets. City Councilman John Woodard.
We have a great rapport with GEO. They do a great job for our country, for our state, for our city, for our county.
And for Adelanto's bottom line, Woodard says a quarter of the city's revenue comes from detention centers, and the facilities create hundreds of jobs. Adelanto is one of four California cities contracting with private prison companies to hold immigrants for ICE. But a bill sponsored by State Senator Ricardo Lara would end such city contracts.
It's a moral thing for California to say we're not going to house people for profit and that, you know, immigrants should have proper redress.
Five people have died in the last 5 years, two of those in the last 3 months. Detention officials reported the causes of death as suicide or natural causes. Advocates say many of those deaths were preventable with proper medical and mental health care. ICE's own investigators found problems at the facility, including health care delays, poor record keeping, and failures to properly report sexual assaults. And at the same time, ICE is looking for more places to hold immigrants as the Trump administration ramps up deportations and cities are looking for more revenue.
Detention's a really good way to fill those budget holes.
That's Daniel Stageman of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York.
The temptation of this funding is going to be very difficult for some of these jurisdictions to resist.
But detention hasn't been a magic bullet. In 2013, Adelanto was on the brink of bankruptcy. City leaders cut almost a quarter of the workforce and closed a firehouse. Councilman Woodard says losing the ICE contract would have been a disaster.
You know, we got to pay for pensions and employees. I mean, they'd have to let off even more employees. This city would be gone.
Woodard is part of a new majority on the city council, pushing a different kind of business to generate revenue and fill city coffers, pot. Last year, Adelanto became one of the first places in California to legalize commercially grown marijuana, issuing dozens of permits. Taxes could potentially provide more than $1 million a month to the city, Woodard says. The Adelanto City Council is weighing whether to lease some land for marijuana cultivation or allow the GEO Group to build another new detention facility there. Meanwhile, the state Senate is due to vote on Senator Lara's bill that would end private detention contracts and hold local governments that detain immigrants for ICE to higher standards of care by the end of the month.
The middle ground here is that we provide still an avenue for the detention of immigrants at the county level where we can protect their rights.
Lara says if California is going to be in the business of holding immigrants for ICE, it should happen in jails run by the government, not by private contractors. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Pickoff-White.
A warning, our next story is disturbing, may even be traumatizing for some listeners, as it was for the author who tells it. Authors live with their characters for years, but how could Affinity Konar live with Joseph Mengele? The angel of death at Auschwitz, he calmly performed unspeakable experimental surgeries on twins, little people, others during the Holocaust. Well, maybe the topic is bearable because also in Affinity Konar's head and in her book Mischling, the Nazi word for mixed breed, are her fictitious victims, a circus family, the twins Stasha and Pearl. She makes us look at the horror they experienced but also fall in love with their resilience and magical thinking. Author Anthony Doerr says it's a book about the most odious of crimes that also manages to have the lightness of a fairy tale. Mischling was on the New York Times list of the 100 most notable books of 2016 and Amazon's top 20 books of the year. It comes out in paperback tomorrow. When we spoke with Affinity, we began by asking, why this difficult topic?
I think I was always sort of drawn to the unspeakable in a certain way and to the effort to try to articulate it. But you don't imagine that there will come a day when you will actually have to talk about it.
Well, and how did that happen? You credit all the other books have been, and many have been written, nonfiction in particular.
Yes, there was one book in particular that just gripped me at a very young age. I found it when I was 16. It was called Children of the Flames by Lucette Lugnato. And this book tells the story of the twins of Auschwitz, but also the story of Mengele. And I feel like my interest was first sparked by the injustice of Mengele, the fact that he was never captured. He would never accounted for any of these horrors, these crimes. And then over time, I found myself shifting my focus, as it should have been, over to the twins.
Are you having difficulty now?
Oh, I feel like I will never be okay talking about this, to be honest. It still feels very fresh, especially now that I'm hearing from people about it. Yeah. I've been privileged to read poetry by people who experienced this directly. A woman who, her mother was a twin who was unable to remain with her own twin. A woman who was able to come to America while her twin perished. Yeah. So, yeah, I had a strange feeling when the book was done, a strange sort of loss. And now it's a very different kind of trajectory. It is reliving it in a different way.
This is traumatic. Let's try in a way that we can to explain, because you say perished, and that becomes an almost antiseptic word. These twins, they are separated because Mengele wanted to see, will one survive and the other not? And the operations are unspeakable. They have organs removed. They have needles in their eyes. It's grotesque.
Absolutely. You know, you start to wonder how much you can bear doing this kind of research. The photographs are obviously things that you don't ever really recover from.
Yeah. Well, but then you also read about twins like Eva Moses Kor and Miriam Moses Zeiger, twin sisters who were incarcerated in Auschwitz, experimented on by Mengele. And it was Moses Kor who co-wrote the book Echoes from Auschwitz, Dr. Mengele's Twins. You found something in this research that also made you think there's something here that's also a life force.
Oh, absolutely. You read these narratives and you also find a sort of innocence that's so strange, and you wonder how they were possibly able to cling to it and to each other. Eva, in her memoirs, will speak about the darkest moments. She'll speak about even, you know, after liberation, during the death marches, being separated from her sister Miriam. And they miraculously find each other again within a sea of people at these one barracks. And they start referring to these barracks as their lucky barracks. Mm. And the language of that just always struck me. You know, the love that they had for each other just carried over everything.
Well, and again, to make clear what we're talking about here, Eva Moses Kaur later remembers a set of gypsy twins who Mengele sewed together at the back because he wanted to see if he could make a Siamese twin. She listened to them scream for days. Gangrene set in and they died. You work that into your account as well.
Yes, because it emphasizes how not only ruthless these experiments were, but also how pointless.
Yeah. It's so disturbing to read, you know, these children with their organs sewn together. But the thing that compels us on is, again, this sense of whimsy. These children who are trying to figure out their reality, both when they're out in Auschwitz, but then also after they're, quote, freed, they still have to make their way as children with animal cloths wrapped around them and no shoes through snow to try to find family or a place to live. And you have one of your twins escaping. Can you read a section that has a little bit of that? Are we in a nightmare? Are we in a dream? Where are we? As they come upon what they think is a temple.
Okay. So, like a brass bell sprinkled with snow, the straw temple rose from the earth with a steady determination. As we neared, we saw that we were not the only ones that this golden column had drawn in. It appeared that bales had been removed from the lowermost of the stack to create a burrow. We could see the discarded piles of hay flung about, their golden threads strewn on the ice, and through a flimsy panel of straw at the rear, we could see a peepery of eyes. They were scattered throughout in the manner of a constellation and with equal glitter. The eyes were friendly, I thought, but I'd been wrong about the friendliness of eyes before.
And of course, the eyes turn out to be other escapees from Auschwitz trying to get some warmth from the cold in a giant pile of hay bales. Again, how much did this parallel the real-life stories that you'd heard of?
It was a really interesting process of being sort of inspired by the personalities. I didn't feel comfortable taking the direct arc of any of their stories and mimicking it on the page. It was very much more a matter of paying tribute to their spirits rather than step-by-step their journeys back home.
Well, and you were also inspired by another story, Gisela Pearl, a real-life Romanian gynecologist sent to Auschwitz, who gave you inspiration for another major character of yours, Dr. Miri. Dr. Miri oversaw the children in Mengele's labs and also a Jew. We're not sure what to think of her until we find out that, well, as the real-life Dr. Pearl did, your Dr. Miri saved women. How did she do that?
She has the terrible task of preserving lives while ending others. She had to perform abortions on women in order to save them within the camp, because to be a pregnant woman within the camp was a terrible thing. You were absolutely doomed.
Because Mengele would want to perform experiments on you.
Yes, he would vivisect women. And these were not just simply cases where Mengele would abort the children. These children would be made to suffer as they died in just extraordinary ways. And Gisela Pearl would save the lives of the mothers, but it absolutely haunted her that she had to abort the children in order to do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, she would later have a sort of peal in her head of, please God, let me deliver a healthy baby. Later in her practice, it was something that always followed her.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the real-life Gisela Pearl tried to kill herself, was interrogated in 1947 when she went to New York on suspicion of assisting Nazi doctors in Auschwitz. She does have to, in some cases, help Mengele perform some of these terrible experiments, but she's sort of doing that while, on the other hand, saving women by performing these abortions in secret. But she finally does become, as your Dr. Miri does, a gynecologist in New York's Mount Sinai Hospital?
Yes. That was a very important storyline for me. I didn't even know it when I started the book. Well, I didn't know many things about how the book would turn out, but I didn't really know that her character would become so vital to the story.
But what do you do now? It sounds like these characters, they're not leaving you.
No, it's very hard because it feels like my life's work, and yet I can't live without writing. I miss the characters deeply, and I find myself just sort of wondering from day to day, what would this person's future be like? Just even from the most minor character within the book. It's something that is still compelling me in some ways. I don't know when it's ever going to leave me.
That's Affinity Konar, her debut novel, Mischling. Affinity, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we spoke with Affinity last September. Mischling comes out in paperback tomorrow. Parents might be seeing hints of mysterious affliction in their high school seniors right now. College students might be feeling it as well. It's senioritis. Adults can experience it later in life when they're quitting a job or making other life changes. But is it just, you know, going into a daydream, or is there psychology behind it? Our next guest says there is. Joining us now, Darsha Narvaez, professor of psychology at the University of Notre Dame. Professor, start. How much of this senioritis phenomenon is about a kind of a regression when you're about to make a big change, and maybe part of you doesn't want to?
I think there's a lot of different, some combination of emotions probably varies by individual of what's going on. So you've got really fear of the future. You don't know what's going to happen. You're being pushed from your nest, what you're used to, and you're moving into the unknown, and you can be paralyzed by that. Stress really impairs your higher order thinking too, making it hard to do schoolwork.
So there can be some serious things going on here?
Yes. There can also be panic because you just don't have the self-confidence of maybe you have a great job ahead waiting for you, but your fear that you can't carry it out. You don't have enough experience, and you just have lots of misgivings about your ability to handle it.
So just kind of stay in bed with the covers over your head.
Yeah.
or look like you're partying. Look, we talk about it typically as being something that high school seniors, college seniors experience, but adults can as well?
That's right. I think it's just a sign of a major transition occurring. Sometimes you can be afraid, you can have a lack of self-confidence, but other times you might actually, a lot of seniors probably are anticipating the next life, their next stage of life, and they're eager to get into it. And it's really hard to focus on finishing up these, you know, mundane tasks because they've lost value. It's almost like a devil-may-care attitude, you know, about the past, and you just want to get on with life to the good stuff ahead. And I think for adults, that can happen too. But I think one of the big things that we in the States, I think, have a harder time with is grief. You know, that deep sadness that we're losing our current nest of support, our familiarity, our relationships, what we love and cherish. Those bonds are now going to have to go into our heads, be abstract, rather than physically present to us. And I think that's a lot of what happens in these major transitions.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, maybe be conscious that there's something more going on and be kind to yourself or your kid. Or it could just be that it's nice out and you want to get out and enjoy it. Talk more about some of the other things that might be going on with a young person overwhelmed at what's next.
That's right. I think they can be afraid of the future. What helps most people is to talk to your friends about it, your family about it, write about it. Learn to breathe deeply. One of my friends told me once that fear is excitement without breath. And I think sometimes we forget to breathe deeply. And these are the times when we really need to remember that and help each other.
You got to become an adult. I mean, truly become an adult.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to say goodbye to childhood. You have to say goodbye to those things you really valued, you really loved, and set up ways, ritualistic ways to say goodbye. You know, senior classes give gifts to their schools. They have memory fests together with friends. Those are the kinds of things that will help you settle down those feelings of sadness, to express them and to move on.
There's a blog, College Parent Central. They have published some studies that show that the current, what they call the emerging adult age population, surveys of them show that they are not as impatient as earlier generations to get out into the world and take on responsibilities. They're less eager to do that, which is interesting. So they may be cocooning themselves.
That's right. Yeah. So that's the other issue.
So we've pointed out some of the problems, but I suppose this could also be a good thing, protecting yourself for a little while before you go out into the world.
Yes. And it also, I think these feelings that we have, if you pay attention to them, are signals for taking action in some fashion. And so that sadness can be a sign of how much you valued those things. And you can actually then turn your attention to appreciating them with your explicit mind, you know, and not just feel it subconsciously.
Yeah. Well, so senioritis, it can happen to a high school senior, college senior, an adult later in life about to make a big change. If you just sort of knock back for a while. We know that it ends because many of us have been through it. But how does it end? What happens?
Well, we usually do snap out of it. I think we process those feelings, whatever they are. We have a little more experience in the new job or the new event of our life that's taking place. Sometimes, though, we do get stuck if life activities have gotten too narrow, that where we only went to work and then we retired. We only took care of children and then they left the nest. Then when those things end, we are kind of in shock because we lost everything that we knew how to do. So we have to kind of keep our balance of our life, put eggs in multiple baskets, and that's the way to buffer ourselves for these things.
That's Darsha Narvaez, professor of psychology at the University of Notre Dame. Darsha, professor, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And a program note, the long Memorial Day weekend marks the beginning of the summer movie season. This afternoon on All Things Considered, critic Bob Mondello has a preview. And a personal note, as I say every Memorial Day, if you are lucky enough to be at the beautiful Long Island National Cemetery in Farmingdale, New York, please stop by Section V, Site 239B, and salute Marine Sergeant Floyd Jones Young's World War II Guadalcanal. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Jeremy Hobson will be back tomorrow. This is Here and Now.